thank everybody for being here on time. Only one announcement I want to make. Is Amanda here yet? Amanda, where are you? Right there, Amanda. She's 32 tomorrow. So Amanda Medley, congratulations. She didn't mind my mentioning her age. I said, if you're 32, you're proud of it. Just to remind you again, of course, next weekend we're at the Crown Plaza Hotel. Okay? You all remember that. And then Kathy Stuznoff asked me to remind you, since the last week that we're here, it is spring break. And a lot of people are going to be using the airplanes and travel and whatever. And it would be very helpful if during the course of the day, if you need airline travel, to confirm it with Kathy today so that she can kind of work on those arrangements. So you wouldn't want to find a time that the plane's all full and everything else and that you couldn't get down. Okay, so arrange that with Kathy today. Then another matter before we get into looking at recommendation three, and it's, in one way it's pertinent. Actually, two people could not make it to the assembly. I think anything less than five or six is actually truly astounding with this larger group and all the responsibilities you have. We heard that Margaret Anderson couldn't make it, and she told us some weeks before, by the way, that was something she just had. Ann Whitelaw Dykes had an emergency and could not make it today. But those things happen, so that's still an exceptional attendance. We do have to make a decision. We're going to, by the way... I love these decisions that we have to make. We're just getting kind of ready for the big decisions we have to make in the fall. So the quicker and easier we make them, the better we get trained, you know, in decision making. Is that two persons are absent today, and the question is, do their names get put in the big hat when we draw the names for those members of the committee? All those in favor? Okay, they're in the hat. Let's now then go on to, and we'll talk to them. I've got a little bit more to say about that. Yes, Alan.
I'm assuming they want to be in the hat?
We don't know that.
Okay.
Diana.
If they don't, they can withdraw if their names are drawn.
We're actually anticipating. In a few minutes, we'll be there. I'll tell you what we're probably going to do is what we've done previously. We'll draw the three names, you know, for each region. If someone finally has to withdraw for whatever reason, we will keep those names just like we did last time. There are a few members sitting around the table here who were part of a second draw that is someone withdrew. So we keep those names in an envelope, and if someone withdraws, then we pull another name. Okay? And it worked very well last time. Yes, Harley.
Should it be mandatory that they attend that meeting to be a member or a member of that committee?
Yes, they should attend the meeting, yes. They should be able to do that. And, again, I'm going to chat about that a little bit so that we get some flexibility in that. Yes, Chris.
Yeah, Jack, this is on a slightly different manner. I notice in the agenda here, we've got question period to start off with.
Yes.
And I've got a question here to you and to the assembly. It's something that I've given some thought. I think we're forming a bit of a family here in the assembly, and I would hate to see us disappear here this fall without having some record of the friends that we made here. So I'd like to make a suggestion that at some point during the next few months, we make an arrangement to have a professional photographer come in on a Saturday night, perhaps, and get photos of the entire assembly done by a professional, something that we will be proud to hang in our homes. I've asked my secretary, Diana, next to me here.
I hope she concurs with that.
to draw up a little suggestion as to how this could be done. And I won't take a lot of time, but I would like the assembly to consider this. And this would include pictures of the assembly. It would include pictures of the staff. It would include pictures of our very favored two lecturers, both Ken and Campbell, so that we can go away from here and have a memento to take with us. So that's my question. Thank you.
That's very nice, Chris. And I'm sure that everybody would agree with that. And I see Marilyn and Don saying that, of course, yes, that's done. We'll look into that. We're also going to get, by the way, each of you will get some kind of a certificate before the end, properly signed by people. So that's it. That's the request. Actually, they put it in a form. It's in writing formally, but I think that by consensus it was we've approved it. Okay, we'll put that to a motion. Thank you very much. Let's go on to recommendation three. We approved this in principle last weekend, and the idea was, of course, that we have presentations to the assembly. We have a committee of ourselves that would make those selections, and that they would be guided by a set of criteria. I'm just going to quickly go through it, in part because I was asked a couple of questions about it this morning, and clearly it's not as clear as I thought it was. So there will be presentations, and we have put a limit in there of 10 minutes and 15 minutes for questions answer. And this was strongly suggested by member Ray Spaxman, who's probably had more experience doing public presentation than anyone else. He's put a limit on it, you know, so that people know in advance, you know, what it's going to be. Then there's applications for a presentation. People will apply. They should give us an executive summary of what they intend to say so that we can know that. Applicants must give a presentation to a public hearing, much similar to the one they're going to give to here if they're successful, so we can hear and see what they have to say. Applications should be given to us by April 30, and we will make decisions in July. The reason for April 30 is so that we can tell members who is going to make a presentation to a public hearing and wants to do it later, so that you can pay special kind of attention to them and see whether or not, you know, they merit it. Number five, in addition to considering applications, and again, this several members suggested this, and it seemed like a very good suggestion, is that in addition to applications, if members hear a particularly good presentation and the person did not apply, you can make a recommendation to the committee that Katie and Kamloops made a wonderful presentation or some other organization, and that we think that you should include this among all the other applicants. And if that person agrees, then that becomes one of the ones that we'll consider. I got that pretty well down, David? Is that how you, right? Okay. So we'll do that. That also allows, by the way, some flexibility in the date. Okay. That April 30, we want people to, you know, abide by that. But that allows us some flexibility. If we hear of somebody or hear a presentation that's really great, the members can take the initiative to send a recommendation to the committee. That seems like a good idea. And, of course, if people need travel expenses, they can apply for a person who might want to come from somewhere, and that gives some kind of equality no matter where you live in British Columbia. To the selection committee, they will select the groups and individuals. The members will be chosen reasonably soon by random draw, one for each of the regions. They're not all equal in population, by the way, but let's not worry about that. It's what we call how does Gordon Gibson call that? A settled political compromise, you know. So we'll choose three for Greater Vancouver, three for the rest of BC, three for the island, and one from the north if we didn't capture someone from the north in that. And the selection committee will use the following criteria. One is quality. How good is the presentation? The mandate, is it consistent with the mandate? And as someone said, by the way, we probably ought not to hear a presentation if it's strictly political, partisan political. Balance is fairly important. That is, overall, the 8 or 10 or whatever that we're looking at, do they present to us a fair balance of opinions? Like, do we get proportional representation here, mixed system here? Do we get a fairly good sense of what's out there so that we can, you know, so that's fair and it's balanced and whatever? That's fairly important, the merit. And then other factors was thrown in there because, you know, you can't anticipate everything in advance. Once you get the 10, 11 members together, they will look at the applications, they will look at this criteria, and then they will make some decisions. For example, it says, you know, the extent of one's history or experience in electoral systems. And if you've got two that are roughly the same, but this organization's been working at it for the last 30 years and this person just kind of discovered that it might be interesting, you may or may not. The committee, I believe, should have that discretion to kind of figure out, you know, which one they may or may not choose. In the end, there's a note there, and there's, I think, a lot of people at last meetings thought this was fairly important. that if there are three or four, whatever, or more, applications of equal merit, they're roughly on the same position, they're for mixed systems, and they're roughly of equal merit, then their names go into the hat, so to speak, and we do by random draw. So that's the proposal. Comments? Questions? Yes, my own. Ellen, yes.
On the recommendation, Jack, under A, where it starts to, where presentations will be limited to 25 minutes, I understand the 10 minutes for presentation. When it says the 15 minutes for questions and discussion, could you elaborate on, I understand the question part, but discussion. Are we asking to enter into debate or discuss amongst ourselves? Or it's been my experience that in a public hearing, we would ask questions for clarification. What is the discussion part of that 15-minute?
Good point, Alan. Essentially, that means question and answer, so that the assembly members can ask questions of the person who makes the presentation, and the presenter can then clarify what they really had meant by that. Discussion, I guess the meaning of discussion was there. It could be, you know, if necessary, it could be just a little bit broader than that. If necessary, a couple of maybe comments across, so that one member might want to talk to another member about some matter. But essentially, it's question and answer and clarification. Do we really understand what the person's doing? RB.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. 2 points. Now, first is about B1. How do we intend to invite such presentations? I mean, is it through the media, or what is the process we take? My second comment is regarding the last sentence, or the notes on page 2 at the bottom.
I'm sorry, RB, you finished?
Sorry?
I'm sorry.
Yeah. About notes on page 2.
Yes.
Now, which refers to submissions that can be considered on equal merit. In such situations, to select on random draw. Now, you explain very well that history and earlier commitments, all these factors will come into the formula. I think by reading this through the lines, it does not reflect exactly that. Now, in other words, it says, further, after selecting a balance of viewpoints as outlined in criterion 3, the committee, when presented with multiple applications, should select the successful applicant by random draw. I think it's 11 of us will end up as the subcommittee members. Certainly, I don't intend to delay the process by going to the next session or something with a revised version of this document. But I think it's absolutely necessary to stress the point that in such situations, the history and earlier commitments must come into the picture. Because, for an example, say parties ABC, the party A may have advocated such changes over many years or more than for some time and got a message to all the British Columbians, whereas someone could walk in tomorrow and come up with a presentation on the same points, and we may consider that on equal merit. So I think it's fairer for us to call that party that has some history, that has shown some earlier commitment to go ahead with such changes. So, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a suggestion as to how we do that. Maybe if you want to keep the same paper and approve this, I stress the point that the subcommittee, whoever going to be there, must take history and other factors into consideration in selecting, and certainly not by random.
Would you
change the document or delete that clause completely, and we go with the understanding that it will be done that way. Thank you.
On this point, Diana?
Yes, on this point, I think the word merit covers that. We will consider the merits, including the history of the individuals making this presentation request.
Mr. Chairman, plus I personally don't think so. I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Are you finished, Diana?
It's plus item 5, other factors in item D.
Mm-hmm. Okay. RB, you want to respond again?
But Mr. Chairman, the sentence clearly says, further, after selecting a balance of viewpoints, as outlined in criterion 3, criterion 3 does not go into history and other factors. That is why I raised this point.
Any other comments on just that particular one? Shoni?
RB took it to read that having considered all the criteria, and anything that met all the criteria, and then if you had several that were on the same issue as is spoken to in number 3, then you would draw them out of the hat. Once having gone through the whole process, not at the beginning of the process, but at the end, if having considered everything, you're still at a standstill. That's how I read it.
Okay. If I might respond, then I think Shoni is roughly interpreting the meaning there. And RB, if you're reasonably happy with that, clearly we have heard your concerns. The idea there, of course, is that we would consider everything that's under the criteria, which includes also, you know, I mean, the matter of extent and history and everything else of that sort. But the committee, when it's there, must be able to consider that and other things that are surprises. I mean, it is not possible, in my judgment, to anticipate all the kinds of things that might come up. And the committee needs a bit of discretion on that matter. And I believe they've heard you, and as chair, I will ensure that they hear you again. I will remind them of your point. Thank you.
All right. Thanks.
Donna?
Thank you. I was just wondering, when we have the people come in here to do their presentations, are we going to be doing that all day Saturday and Sunday of our first weekend back?
The suggestion here is Saturday afternoon and Sunday morning. And again, I think I'd like the committee to consider that when they get together. Are you then ready for the full question on this? All those in favor as now modified in detail? Any contrary? Thank you very much. We're now going to draw the members of the... are we ready with a hat? Okay, we're going to do the interior first, just in case we don't get one from the north. I hope we get one from the north, because we have a definition of the north, but that might not be your definition. So.
Some of them have seen the hat before, and of course some haven't.
Yeah. This hat, by the way, wasn't used in the first two or three sessions we had, but it was used in the majority. This is such a famous hat. I don't know whether, when we're all finished, by the way, at the end of December, whether this goes in the archives or whether we randomly draw which member gets it. Christina says she paid for it. Ken McKinnon, we're going to ask you to come up and pick. Ken, by the way, as you probably know, I've introduced him once. He's from the Yukon. He is going to be a commissioner for their electoral review, and he has been here at every session. Finds it very interesting. A lot of you have interacted with Ken. He's currently the chancellor of the College of the Yukon, for many, many years a member of the Yukon legislature. So that's ready. Pardon? Three names. Yep. Three names.
And honest.
Actually, we did a police check. First member. We got a member from the north, Bill Jackson.
Nice fix, eh, Bill? From the north.
Wolf Strohs. I'd like to get a female. Here we have it. Anna Rankin. So Bill, Wolf, Anna from the north. Three members from the north. Great. I will be chatting with the members later in terms of how we get the logistics of this going. So now we're going to do Lower Mainland. This is what random draw does, you know. Deb Buick. Right, Deb. Where are you? Shoney Field. I should get a mail next time. Evelyn Krenz. Where's Evelyn? I will do the island. See, pure random when small numbers, you all need a whole bunch of statisticians in here. You don't get the represent. The larger the group that you randomly draw, as we did going from 79 to 158, you get a much better representation, of course, of the population. You know that. This is the island, yeah. Thank you. Diana Byford. Wow. Give me a man. We got a man, John Chapman.
How about would you like that, sir?
Another man would kind of bring a balance if we can. But we do not. Heidi Ryman. Where are you, Heidi? Thank you very much, Ken. That's it. So that's it, and I'll be chatting with these 9 members, and we'll look about times and to get together, and we will keep you very well informed as to how we go along and keep you informed of decisions and process and everything else. Thank you very much. It is now my pleasure to turn over to Ken Carty.
Good morning. Oh, we've got the screen. Well, we've got this screen working, not that one this morning. Is this one going to work? Well, we'll give it a little minute. We're going to talk about mixed systems this morning. I think some people have been waiting for this session, hoping that somehow it would resolve all the contradictions and tensions and be a magic mixed formula would come out of the hat. Well, like all the systems, it's sort of mixed. We've got one screen up and one screen not up. The whole idea, and to call mixed systems a kind of separate family is maybe a little bit misleading. I mean, it's more like a kind of blended family, I suppose. It's an attempt to take the advantages of different systems and marry them together and create something new and something different. And until, in fact, very recently, mixed systems weren't used very widely at all. They've become much more common in the last decade or so as people have experimented with them and tried to develop them. Of course, you always take a certain amount of risk when you mix things. You never quite know whether the mix is going to work. You hope to get the advantages of both systems. You certainly hope you don't get the disadvantages of both. But, you know, these kinds of trade-offs are always implicit in any of these kinds of arrangements. I want to start by talking about a number of different kinds of mixes and suggest there's perhaps 5 kinds that one could think about. They're of different sorts, and some are more popular and common than others. The first would be simply to mix different kinds of formula at different stages of a kind of count process. In some sense, these might be seen as versions of a kind of proportional representation system. But the Austrians present a kind of interesting example because they have a two-tiered system, a kind of level system that Gladys was asking about yesterday. And at the first level, they use a system that favors small parties. It gives small parties a real advantage. It's a remainder system using the hair quota. But then at the second level of allocation, they move dramatically in the other direction to use a system that favors larger parties. I suppose to try and make sure they have parties that have stronger positions maybe to take the lead in forming a government. And then they complicate that by using district magnitudes of really enormous variation from as small as 6 to as large as 39. And that kind of mix of features really produces systems that are working really rather differently at different stages in the count and in parts of different processes. So one might think of it as a proportional system, but by deliberately mixing different formula and different district magnitudes, they have very different consequences for the system. And so that's a kind of preliminary level of a kind of mix that has some real consequence. The second kind of mix would be one in which we're mixing different families across one country. And here we can think of the German example, for instance. What the Germans do is they say, well, we're going to elect half our members by one system and the other half by quite a different system. The first half are members chosen in a plurality, single member, first past the post kind of system like we use here now in British Columbia. The other half are elected by a party list system. Voters have, in German case, two votes. They get to vote for their in the local constituency level, and then they get to vote for the party in the party list system. They have to make decisions about the kind of arrangements in the PR system. They happen to use a hair quota. They have to make decisions about thresholds, and they have threshold decisions about you have to get 5% of the national vote to get any of the share out of the list seats, or another way you can get a share out is by winning a number of constituencies. It's currently three. Basically, it's designed to be a proportional representation system in its overall effect. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. But it's also designed to try and get what they perceive as some of the advantages of a radically different system, a plurality, single-member, local system, tacked on to the side. So we've got two systems working in a parallel there. And that's a very deliberate kind of mix. Well, a third kind of mix would be where you mix different families in different parts of the political system. The French use this to elect the Senate. In small districts, mostly rural districts, they use majority formula in a traditional French kind of preferential ballot way. But in larger areas and more urban areas where the district magnitude is greater, they use proportional representation because they think that those different systems serve different kinds of communities in different kinds of ways. And that, of course, remember we talked earlier one weekend about different systems that have been used in Canada. That's a kind of version of what happened in two Canadian provinces for quite a long time. In Alberta and Manitoba, when they used one kind of system in rural areas, they used a majoritarian system, a preferential vote. And then in urban areas, they used single transferable vote by multi-member ballot because they thought those kind of communities were different enough that different systems would suit them. So that's quite a different kind of mix. The German kind of mix is everybody has both options. This is that you try and mix them in areas where it's more appropriate. Well, there's another kind of mix, a fourth kind of mix, if you like, where you actually present different kind of options on the ballot. Most ballots provide you a choice of a candidate or a political party. The Russians provide the option of none of the above. It's an option that's, in fact, growing, increasing popularity in the United States. If you go on the web, you'll find hundreds of websites devoted to trying to promote the none-of-the-above option. And there's variations on how such a system might work. The Russians basically use it in a way that if you don't like any of the parties or any of the candidates that are on offer, you can tick none-of-the-above. If none-of-the-above wins, they have to have another election. You have to get another set of choices. And you keep voters in theory can keep getting enough choices until they find one they like. Well, that's in some sense a quite a qualitatively different kind of choice that you're offering voters. You're saying, look, none of this will do. Start again and get it right, rather than forcing us to choose among some set that we've been given. Some of you will have been on the web and will have seen there's a submission to the assembly which is proposing a none-of-the-above option, which would say, rather than having another election, you just draw a member from the public at random and make them, or perhaps from those who voted for none of the above, and make them a member of the legislature. Of course, when you do that, of course, you take away the electoral power to hold them accountable once you go to a kind of draw system. And the thing, of course, to remember there in elections, it's not the current election that's really critical. It's all the fact that there's going to be another one. It's not the current election that holds politicians as accountable as the fact that they know they've got to come back the next time. And be answerable and be responsible to it. And so variations on none of the above might strengthen that or might weaken that kind of dynamic. And I guess the last kind of option that might be worth thinking about are options that use different systems for different choices that go on at the very same time. And the Australian case is a good example of this. The Japanese case might be another one. And that's where you are having elections at the same time for different assemblies and using radically different systems. And it's mixed in the sense that the political parties are having to compete at the same time in quite different systems. In Australia, for instance, they have elections for the House of Representatives and the Senate on the same day as part of a general election. Members for the House of Representatives are chosen by a majority preferential ballot system. Campbell talked about that last weekend. Members for the Senate, as Campbell said yesterday, are elected by a single transferable vote system, which has been kind of corrupted by a ballot structure, into essentially a party list system. But the political parties, in the very same time, are having to, out of one side of their existence, say, well, this is how we're competing in the majority system, but they're also having to compete in the PR, essentially, list system at the very same time. Because they're putting up candidates, they're running campaigns, and voters are going to the polling place and be giving a ballot that says, do this in this system and do that in that system, and making very different kind of strategic choices because the kind of alternatives you have. So while they're not electing them to the very same assembly, they're electing them as part of the same political process and making judgments on the kind of government, both in the House and the Senate, they're likely to get. So that's a very different kind of mix. That's not one that immediately comes to our concern because we don't have an upper house in the British Columbia legislature. None of the Canadian provinces any longer have upper houses. But of course, some people might say, well, it's a good thing that we have the same system at the provincial level as at the federal level as at municipal levels, because that, you know, means you're less likely to have spoiled ballots. People who understand the system different. If every time you went to a ballot box, you had a different kind of system, that would be confusing, and that wouldn't be a good thing. So that's maybe another thing to think about and to keep in the back of your mind. So there's a range of, when we think about mixed systems, we want to think about there's different kinds of ways in which you can mix things. And there's these kinds of examples, and one could point to others, in which different systems have been mixed in different places at different times. Well, why mixed systems? Well, as I kind of suggested at the beginning, the real purpose is to try and get the advantages out of both. And as we've seen, two of the big dividing lines among systems concern themselves with the issue of local representation. Do I have a local member of parliament that I can go to and that she will answer to me and then I know that at the next election she has to come back and be accountable? Or are there 23 members from this big area I live in and there's no possible personal connection between voter and politician? Some systems provide for that, others don't. But we also know that there's a real concern about proportionality. Should parties really get the same share of seats as they get votes? And we know that to have that feature, you have to maybe sacrifice some on the local representation side. So these two big fundamental issues and principles seem to be in kind of conflict. So one of the attractions of mixed systems, one of the things that's drawing attention to them, is the possibility that maybe you can have a bit of both. And that if you can have a bit of both, maybe you don't have to give up too much. Maybe you do. And so the question is, how would such kind of systems work? Can you provide for these kinds of concerns in different kind of systems? And that's at the, I think, the end of the day, what's driving this kind of growing interest in mixed systems. Up until about 1990, Germany was really the only major established democracy that worked this kind of system. A system put in place really after the Second World War because the extreme form of proportional representation that had been used in the period between the wars had led, in, some would argue, partially contributed to the collapse of the German regime. Well, there's different ways of doing this. One of the most common ways is this business of having different families working across the country at the same time. I pointed to the example of Germany. The New Zealanders do essentially this. It's been recently adopted in the new assemblies that have been created for Scotland and Wales in the United Kingdom. They now have their own local assemblies. So basically, the idea is to split the legislature into two parts. Some members elected in single-member districts. We know about that. You could do that by a plurality rule or a majority rule. But some members elected by some kind of proportional representation system, a list system. But once you do that, you still have this long set of decisions to make. For the local districts, you have to make decisions about district magnitude. It's mostly one. That's probably the point of it. But you might have two-member districts in some areas. You have to make decisions about formula, plurality or majority. You have to make decisions about ballot structure, preferential or ticks and crosses, kind of ordinal kinds of decisions. So all those kinds of decisions have to be made because you've got this kind of one system sitting there. But then you've got this other system sitting beside it, and you have to make the whole regular range of PR decisions for it. So it's not like you've escaped making decisions. In fact, you've doubled the kind of decisions you've got to make. And for list seats, you have to decide, well, what kind of formula? Remainder systems or average systems? And what kind of quotas and divisors and those kinds of things we talked about? What kind of structure should there be to lists, open and closed, and so on? What would be the basis of allocation, various tiers and levels, and so on? Should there be thresholds? So there's a wide range of these kind of decisions you have to make, and you have to think about, of course, how decisions on one side might influence decisions on the other side and how they can be meshed, because you're trying to achieve what are on the surface contradictory ambitions by bringing some kind of a system together. So a whole range of decisions would have to be made. And you can have different kinds of, as I say, decisions at different levels, and we might talk a little bit about some of those. Well, we might talk about the purpose of the list seats, because there's different ways to think about that. We know what the purpose of the constituency seats are. That's to give us a local member in the kind of traditional way we think about those. But what are you doing when we put on right beside it a whole set of party list members as well? Well, there's a couple of ways one could think about it. The first is the so-called mixed member proportional, MMP. And the idea of MMP systems is to compensate for the fact that constituency systems are not proportional. They produce the kind of disproportional results we talked about and saw, and that produce artificial majorities that make it difficult for some groups to get elected. That sometimes can produce wrong winners. All those kind of things that we reflected on. Well, the idea of a mixed member proportional is to say, well, wait a minute, we want to try and make, at the end of the day, the whole thing work proportionally. We want to compensate for all the distortions in some way. So the list systems are there to compensate for anything that's, quote, gone wrong, end of quote, in the first allocation. And so those seats are kind of thought of as a kind of proportional top-up, a kind of arrangement. So let's imagine that half the members are being elected by in constituencies and half the members are being elected on a list. One party might win all of the seats in the constituencies, or 77 out of 79. I mean, these things can happen. The other parties have got none. But you look at the voting results, and it might well be that the party that won all the seats only won half the votes. They won half the votes plus one in every single district, therefore they won the district, but they've only got half the votes in total. And so you're going to say, well, they've already got half the seats. They won them all. So they're not going to get any of these extra seats from the party lists, because we're going to use those to compensate the parties that didn't get any seats, even though they got votes in the first half. So in some sense, the share that a party might get from the list is determined both by the votes they get, but also how many seats they've won. If they won a lot of seats, they're not going to get very many of them. They don't need them. They've got, because the idea is to make the final bottom line total kind of proportional. What this tends to mean in practice is that the large parties win most of the constituency seats. That's who wins constituency seats, the person who has the most votes. That's the kind of winner-take-all principle. So large parties tend to end up with most of the constituency seats. Smaller parties tend to win the list seats because they're not big enough to win that many constituency seats. So that's one of the dynamics at work. So that's how MMP systems work. The best-known examples that are Germany, that has had it since the Second World War, New Zealand, which adopted it about 15 or 8 years ago. It's used in Bolivia and Venezuela, I think, in their systems. And it's very recently been adopted for the new legislatures in Scotland and in Wales. All of those people use quite different arrangements on their party list side of their system because they were trying to do different kinds of things. They use different formulas, different thresholds, The Scottish system is not particularly proportional. They're not trying to help small parties too much. The New Zealand and German ones rather more. Okay, so that's one thing you might want to do on with the list seats. But there's another whole pattern, which is called mixed member majoritarian, MMM. We've got to have short forms for everything, right? And the MMM system is based on the idea that you win what you get in your constituency side, and then you win what you get in your party list side. And the two aren't really connected. So if you win half the votes, all the seats on the constituency side, well, you get to keep them. You won them. But then if you win half the votes on the proportional representation side, you should get half of those seats. So the two systems are running really in parallel, not particularly connected. Well, that's not a system where, and if you add those up, you can see if a big party won all the seats and then won half of the PR seats, they'd have three quarters of all the seats. So that's not a system designed at the end of the day to be proportional. That's a system that's designed to give smaller parties some seats to compensate them or to supplement the arrangement that exists, that they didn't get any seats in the constituency carve-out. They should get some. They'll get some share on the proportional representation side. So it's a kind of attempt to provide some supplementary seats for smaller parties. But it's not a proportional system. Not designed to be proportional. Half of it's proportional, but when you add that half to the half that's quite unproportional, you don't get a proportional bottom line, which is exactly the point of the MMP balance. This is a system which is designed to help large parties. In fact, gives big advantages to large parties, and maybe, in fact, in many ways, more disproportional than lots of even plurality systems tend to work out. And in fact, in mixed systems that have been adopted in the last decade, this has been very commonly adopted. There's lots of them appearing in Eastern Europe and so on. They're much more commonly used, in some of the newer democracies than the MMP systems. But in terms of established democracies that have adopted them, both Italy and Japan, when they went about reforming their electoral systems in the 90s, went in this direction from very different points of view. The Italians had had a very proportional system. They were determined to have a much less proportional system. Just at the time that New Zealand was going to more proportionality, Italy said, well, we want to go away from the kind we have. And so they went to a version of this. And the Japanese went from a very idiosyncratic, single, non-transferable vote system to this kind of arrangement. But it looks on the surface kind of like mixed member proportional, because they have the same two things running in track. But they work fundamentally differently, and one needs to be pretty careful about that. Well, a second characteristic of the mixed seats is, I suppose, once we get beyond why do you want these list seats and what are you hoping to do with them, the question of what the relationship between the two are. How do you balance them? Because you can see that there's a kind of tension built into the system, isn't there? Part of the point of having local representation, having individual constituencies, so people can get to know their members, they can have someone they can talk to, the members will service the constituencies. But if you have the same size of assembly, and if you're going to have two sets of members, that might mean having fewer local districts. If you wanted to have a mixed member system in British Columbia, for instance, if you said, well, we'll start with the assembly that's now 79, we're going to go to some kind of mixed member system, proportional or majoritarian, those are decisions we'll figure out later. That means some of the 79 are going to go on the list side. So that means we're going to have fewer individual constituencies. Well, fewer individual constituencies mean bigger individual constituencies. Bigger individual constituencies, of course, reduce the capacity of people to be connected to their politicians. So there's a kind of tension there. And, of course, it means heavier workloads, constituency workloads for those members. There's now fewer of them going to be doing it. So fewer local districts, the larger they've got to be and the heavier the workloads for those members. On the other hand, if you have fewer list seats, and have more constituency seats, then your chances of getting it, making it proportional, if that's what you want to do, go down. Because you need a certain number of them, or you're not going to get to proportionality at the end of the day, particularly in small legislatures, If you've got lots of plurality seats and you got an election like we had the last time, almost nothing would help you unless you had a large number of, proportionally large number of list seats. So there's a kind of tension there. You know, what number? The best estimates say there's no magic formula, but proportionality probably requires at least a quarter of the seats to be on the list. Most systems that use it have more than that. Some estimates say you could probably get away with as few as a quarter. The Germans use half. I think the New Zealanders now are 60-40, and the Scottish and Welsh assemblies are in about that range as well. So that proportion is quite important in terms of how close you can get to proportionality, what kind of proportionality you can get to, what the consequences are for local districts. And part of the point of doing this is you want to have that. So there's a set of kind of trade-offs involved in that that are kind of important. The New Zealand Royal Commission, they had a Royal Commission in the early 1990s that looked at, maybe it was a bit late 1980s, gosh, time's going by quickly, that made their recommendations about their new electoral system. At the time, the New Zealand Parliament had 95 members in it. They said, look, we really think you should have 140 to make it work. I mean, what they were really trying to say is, we don't want to reduce the size of our local districts at all. We just want to add some proportionality. So they actually say in the report, in an ideal world, we'd go to 140, and that would work really well for our situation. And then they said, but we don't think the voters will go for this, so we're going to recommend 120. I mean, it's really quite open and transparent what they're saying there, saying, look, you know, we want a little bit more because we don't want to sacrifice the local member. We think this is about as far as we can go, and it would work well. And in the end, that's what the New Zealanders adopted, and it has worked, I think, relatively well in these terms. Okay, you've got two systems at work. You've got the local seats. You've got the party list seats. People have one vote or they have two votes. Well, you can do either. See, the numbers aren't very clear. You could have two votes. One vote for the candidate, for my local candidate. One vote for the party list with whatever arrangements and ballot structures and so on you adopted there. If you give people two votes, it allows them to split their vote. They might say, well, you know, for the local district, I know that I'm a real supporter of the marijuana party, but I don't think they can win this local district. You know, it's full of Gordon Campbell fans, and they probably won't vote. So I'm going to vote for a big party here, but I want to give the small party, the marijuana party, some support. And they can win some on the PR side. They can't win it on the local side because only a big party is likely to win. But on the PR side, they have a good chance, so I'm going to vote for theirs. So that allows voters to split their votes, reflecting kind of different interests and making kind of strategic calculations. And that kind of strategic voting can probably help small parties that don't win local seats. And we see that, in fact, strategic voting has become an important part of what New Zealanders do now. In some areas, up to 30% of the people vote for a candidate of one party in their local district and a different candidate in the party list system because they want to support that particular party. But they've decided that party probably can't win in their local area. So they're making kind of calculations and saying, well, let me look at the candidates that can win in my area and I'm going to choose the one that I like best or dislike least or whatever. So two votes is one possibility, and that's certainly used in a number of systems. Another possibility is to say, well, no, we'll just have one vote. And you vote for your local candidate, and we'll just sum up those votes for candidates, and they will count as the party vote. And the number of votes that all the candidates win will be the proportion that the party gets, and that number will be applied to the system to decide how many seats are shared out in the list system. Well, why would you do that? Well, one way you might do it if you wanted to prevent split-ticket voting. You can imagine that big political parties would have some kind of interest in trying to keep their supporters voting for them and not encouraging them to kind of split their tickets. And so you've got to think that that's a system which, at the end of the day, is likely to work to the advantage of larger parties by preventing that kind of voting. It's also a device to prevent people from, you might say, manipulating the system or cheating, because it avoids the possibility of parties running on separate labels. I mean, if you were really hard-nosed about it, you might decide, look, we're going to run as the really good party We're going to have the really good party, and we're going to have candidates in every district. And they're going to win lots of districts. But we're not going to run as a really good party on the party list side. We're going to run as the trying harder party, because that's a kind of neat name. And so people will vote for us in the local districts as the really good party. And in the party list system, they'll vote for us as the trying harder party, because our voters will know we're the same thing. And maybe we'll win 35% of the votes as the trying harder party on the list side. And when they come to do the carve up, they'll say, well, how many local seats has the trying harder party won? They'll say, well, they won none. So they're entitled to 35% of the total assembly because they won 35% of the vote. So we've got to give them a huge part of the list system. But the same group under a different name will have won it as the, I forget what I called them already, the better party. And so you could see that people, in fact, could run under different names and get big advantages. And in some sense, there's some evidence that this was done in Italy the first time they did it. Some parties ran under one name here and one name, a different name there, and got way more than that the logic of the system was supposed to give them. So to prevent that kind of stuff, and otherwise prevent it, you'd have to have rather complicated sets of laws. You might decide you only want to give people one vote to prevent that kind of possibility. So there are a series of calculations about that, and they have real implications for the options that voters have and the consequences then of the way they exercise those choices. Can candidates run in both parties, in both parts? Can you be a candidate in the local constituency and be on the top of the party list? Well, mostly these systems say yes, but they could say no. Mostly they say yes, and I think it's because the politicians think it's in their interest mostly to say yes. But it means that a prominent party official can make sure they get elected, even if their party is very unpopular in their part of the country. Let's say that you were a prominent French-speaking politician, but you came from an English area in a country that was divided by language, or you could imagine the same thing by ethnicity or religion or whatever. And the party would say, well, look, this is really one of our important figures, but because our party's not very strong in their area, they don't have any chance of running. Now, they want to run in the area. They're prepared to go to the people and carry the flag, but they're probably going to lose, so we should put them on the list as well. So that's a way of making sure that prominent figures can get elected, even though their party might not be particularly popular in their area. What it also, and that's basically, I think, why most systems that use this kind of two-barrel approach do this. On the other hand, what it does mean is that people who are defeated in local constituencies then end up getting elected to the legislature. You lose your local area, people vote against you. Maybe you're even the member. They threw you out. But you're on the top of the list, so you go back into the legislature. A lot of people think this is really weird. They don't like it. The Japanese have it, and they hate it. Japanese politicians love it. Japanese people hate it. They call these the zombie politicians because these are the guys we killed with a stake, and they kind of reappeared in Parliament. The South Koreans have it, too, and they call them the zombies. So this seems to be a kind of... the Germans have it, and it doesn't occur to anybody this is an unreasonable way of doing things. So, I mean, again, there are. I'm not saying Germans like zombies. I'm not going there. But what we're really saying, of course, then there's different kind of cultural understandings and expectations about what's kind of reasonable. But that is one of the possibilities, and in fact, it's a strong likelihood that you're going to have lots of members who go fight a constituency, get defeated, but then get elected because, in fact, the people who are prominent politicians in their party who are fighting in bad areas are probably going to be put near the top of the list just to do that. So you're likely to have a fair number of those kind of people. What happens when there's vacancies? Well, we're back up sort of on this side. The vacancies on the list side tend to be handled in the way they are in most list systems. And most of the party list systems don't have by-elections because they're based on kind of overall proportionality of the whole country. If someone dies, gets run over by a bus, or appointed to some important commission in the Senate and leaves, they just go to the next name on the list and say, okay, he's out, now you're in. And so on the list side, that's the kind of normal way of going about it, and that's how it would happen. But on the constituency side, what do you do? Because if you have a different arrangement, then you've got members in different kind of situations. In Germany, they say, well, we ought to keep it even. So if a constituency member resigns, we'll just take someone else off the list. If we appoint someone to something and make them an ambassador to Canada, then we'll just go down the list and we'll know who the next person's going to be. The New Zealanders say, no, that's not the point of local representation. We're going to have a by-election in the traditional sense. So this means, of course, that parties' memberships are subject to two different sets of conditions. If a list member goes, it's okay because you can replace them. If a constituency member goes, you got to fight. You might win the seat or you might not. New Zealand goes, having made this decision, then turns it around by saying, but the whole system is supposed to be proportional. So if anybody switches their party or leaves, then the seat is declared vacant. So even a constituency member in New Zealand can't change from one party to another, because as soon as they do that, they say, oh, no fair, time out, it's supposed to be proportional, therefore the seat is vacant. So you have to make a kind of series of decisions about that, and they might be different on different sides, and if they are different, of course, that might well then create a kind of system with different kinds of members. Well, there are some issues of mixed member systems that are worth talking about, thinking about. Mixed member systems, if they're proportional, if they're MMP systems, are designed to be precisely that. At the end of the day, they are proportional representation systems in that they facilitate the proliferation of smaller parties, give them more chances to run, give them more chances to win. That's likely to then, of course, increase the possibilities of coalition government and all that. So just because the two tracks are at play in a place like New Zealand or Germany, at the end of the day, the overall working of the system is more like a proportional system than a plurality system. That's either an advantage or disadvantage, depending where you're sitting. They do create two kinds of members. And this is a controversial set of issues on which there, I don't think, is a fixed opinion. But there are some members who represent constituencies. And they have all the traditional obligations of constituency members. They have to go to their constituents and get reelected. They have to service the issues and the concerns of their particular constituents. That's why we have them. On the other hand, you've got a series of list members who don't have any constituency responsibilities at all. A party might say, well, you ought to concentrate in this area to help build up the party strength. But they can busy themselves with issue politics and a range of other kinds of concerns. Does that create problems? Well, the short answer is sometimes and sometimes not. It depends. Certainly in Germany, where there's been the longest history, there's really been no difference between the members. They work basically the same way. They do the same sorts of things. By and large, I think the main reason is because there's been no tradition of tradition of constituency service, constituency representation in Germany. They'd move from a kind of very hyper-proportional system before that they had in place before the Third Reich. And so constituency members don't do the kinds of things that constituency members do in systems like ours where we have this kind of tradition. We know that already in the Scottish Assembly that tension is kind of bubbling around. It's bubbling around particularly in the Labour Party, which is the dominant party in Scotland and controls the Scottish Assembly. Constituency members are muttering that they're doing all the work and the list guys are having a free ride. New Zealand, it's, I think, a more mixed story. We'll hear a little bit about that from Elizabeth McClay next weekend. So in some sense, the answer to that is, well, yes, they have different kinds of members. What the consequences of that are probably depend a little bit on the expectation of the voters, on the behavior of the politicians, on the possibilities of making the system work. It's probably true to say that, by and large, it's going to mean that you're not only going to have two kinds of members, you're probably going to have two kinds of political parties. I would argue New Zealand they probably have three kinds, but at least two. The large parties are the ones that are doing most of the constituency kind of work. Most of their members are going to be involved in constituency representation. That's the nature of single-member plurality systems. The smaller parties are often going to have no constituency members. There's a number in both the German Bundestag and the House of Representatives in Wellington in New Zealand that have no constituency obligations at all. And so those small parties obviously have a different dynamic, a different set of practices, a different kind of internal balance of power than large parties that are more decentralized with local members being deeply rooted in their constituencies. And, of course, then at election time, they compete in different terms and in different kinds of ways. Okay, well, that's basically how the mixed systems that people have talked quite a lot about work, the ones that work in parallel. But just to kind of illustrate another kind of set of possibilities, we can talk about systems that work with different arrangements in different parts of the community. As I said, that's what happens in the French Senate. That was the experience in Manitoba and Alberta between the wars in this country. And the logic of those kind of systems is really that, look, different communities have different kinds of needs. Their politicians have different representational challenges in getting around, speaking to voters. Voters in sprawling rural areas that don't have lots of sophisticated municipal services may well have more call on their provincial MLA than someone who's in downtown Vancouver in terms of the nature of the way public services are provided. That they need some kind of access to a member. That the member of a legislature from an urban area in the middle of Surrey, has 23 square blocks to cover and can walk from one end of the district to another in an hour. And the member from a sprawling rural northern district has many hours of driving across blistery roads and mountain passes to be able to even get to their constituents from time to time. So that, well, we think of electoral systems in terms of what the voters need. We also need to think about how well then the representatives are able to do their job. And so they have different kinds of challenges and different kinds of needs. And, of course, political parties are going to work very differently in big sprawling areas and in densely packed little local areas. Now, political parties are the organizations that mobilize people, that involve them in the process. You know, the NDP in Surrey can meet easily every month on an hour's notice. You know, they can phone around and people can gather. But if a political party in Skeena decides to have a meeting with people from all over the district, that takes a long time to organize. It takes hours for people to get there. You can't have them as frequently and so on. So the organizations are going to work differently. So voters and politicians and political parties all have different kind of challenges in different parts of the country. So one argument is that one of the ways you can do that is to have electoral systems that facilitate different kind of arrangements in these kind of ways. And this is essentially the logic that lies behind this kind of mix, rather different than what we have. And it would really involve having fairly low district magnitudes, probably of one or maybe two in rural areas, but higher district magnitudes in urban areas. And with higher district magnitudes, you can bring in your proportional representation dimensions. With low district magnitudes, you preserve the kind of the local connections. So rather than doing it all across the system as a whole, you parcel up the system in terms of what areas need different kinds of arrangements. As I say, that was the Alberta and Manitoba scheme for a number of years. Basically, what they did was they used majority or plurality single-member districts in big, thinly populated areas. That was mostly the rural part of the provinces. And they used a single transferable vote or PR list systems in more dense urban areas. They mostly used STV, because as Campbell showed yesterday, there was a kind of logic and it provided for a local connection. But at the end of the day, the proportionality of those systems would depend on the balance between the two. Same kind of problem we talked about in the other kind of mix. At the end of the day, how proportionally you might get a system, and that's one of the goals, is what kind of balance. If you have most of your members out in these remote rural areas with only one member, you're not going to have a very proportional system. If, in fact, most of the members are in the multi-member PR systems, be the STV or list systems, then you can get a lot closer to proportionality. So, again, it's the balance of the two that becomes really quite critical in that process. One of the advantages that was held was that all members are responsible to a constituency in this kind of system. There are two kinds of members in the sense that some members are the only member in their district, and some members might share the district with two or three or four others. But they all have constituency connections and constituency obligations in a way that the other kind of mix doesn't have. And that provides maybe a kind of a parallelism. And one of the other arrangement, one of the other possibilities of this system is that you can use the same kind of ballot structure for voters. If you have in the mixed member proportional and mixed member majoritarian systems, people have to come in and vote on a party list ballot, and then they have to vote on a constituency ballot, and those might look very different and be counted in different kind of ways. Under this kind of arrangement, this kind of mix, you could have the same ballot structure. You would use an STV-looking kind of ballot, and you'd 1, 2, 3, 4. You rank order your preference of candidates. Some districts would end up electing one member. Some districts would end up electing more. So the possibilities, and that's essentially what happened in Alberta and Manitoba when they were using these kind of systems. Well, do we want a mixed system in British Columbia? I've talked about two different kinds of ways that have been mixed and some of the issues that come out of them, which we know a little bit and have some experience with. In fact, the possibilities are, constrained only by our imagination in some kind of ways, because we're talking about trying to mix different bits of systems in different kind of ways. So the kind of models we've talked about are ones that are out there and have worked and we have some experience with, but that's not to say one couldn't invent something different. So the question is, what do we want from an electoral system that any individual family can't deliver? I mean, that's the question of, are there bits and pieces we want to pick from different systems to mix in some kind of ways? One of the ways we can think about it is, what are we missing? Are we missing proportionality? Are we missing local representation? Are we missing thresholds? Do we need more parties? Do we need less parties? What do we want in BC that we don't have now? And if we can kind of work that out, is there some combination that meets our particular needs in this province? The only way we can answer that is if we're clear on what our needs are, what we think the needs are, what do we want out of a particular system. But in some sense, I think it's going to come down to there are some big questions lurking in the background of these kind of systems, and they lurk somehow in the background of a lot of the things we've been talking about. Do we want a system that provides for local representatives? What do we think local representation means? How big could a district be before it's not local representation? We all have, those of us who live in urban areas, have local councillors that represent a few of us. Then we have MLAs. We think of them as local representatives. We have MPs. They represent districts twice as big as our MLAs. Does that count as local representation? What are the boundaries of that? If we had a district with 2 or 3 members, would we see them as local representatives? So how do we think about that? And if we think we want a system that provides for local representatives, what do we mean by that? What are we talking about? Do we want a system with some kind of proportional element? Well, and if we say yes, how proportional does it need to be? I mean, what's our standard? Does it need to be pure proportionality, or would we like it just a little bit better? Or do we think, let's try and devise a system that'll prevent the worst excesses? We might say, well, it doesn't have to be purely proportional, but we don't want anything like 2001 again, where one party gets 77 seats and the other, and everybody else gets 2. That's just way too off the scale. Or you might say, well, one out of 20. So, by introducing some proportionality, are we just trying to kind of provide some help for smaller parties? Are we trying to go all the way? Is there some middle ground? How do we think about that? How do we think about proportionality? Do we want both? Do we really care? What would it take to get them? What do we give up when we tilt this way or tilt that way in looking for particular elements of a mix? Well, those are all kind of questions. The kind of examples I provide this morning are only some you can draw on, certainly any of the things we've talked about in the last few sessions in thinking about mixed systems. We've got time, I guess, for a question or two, then we'll have coffee, and then we can go. Yes?
I'm wondering when was the mixed system used in Alberta and Manitoba, and why was it abandoned?
It was used basically from about the end of the First War till sometime after the second one. It was abandoned in Alberta in the 50s. I think basically Social Credit finally came to the conclusion that they could win easier without it. Sometimes they'd lose 1 or 2 seats under that system, and they didn't like losing any seats. it didn't much matter what system they used in Alberta. It's never mattered what system they used in Alberta, right? Only one party ever wins, the same crowd. Manitoba has a much more, and basically they had an election in which the opposition did win a few seats. They said enough of that. And Premier Manning, as he was, Preston Manning's father was the premier for the longest running premier in the history of the British Commonwealth, tells something about Alberta. But decided, well, enough of this. We'll just go to a plurality system. It'll be easy and clean sweeps. Manitoba had a long, complicated party history with the progressives and the liberals and the conservatives. And for most of the period, it had a kind of progressive liberal coalition. And that kind of came unstuck in the period after the war. And I don't know the exact inner details of why they decided to abandon it. By that time, I think they were the only province left. And I think they thought, well, we'll just go to a current system. The balance between Winnipeg and the rest of the province was changing. I don't have a real clear sense of what the background story of those calculations were. And in some sense, I think they saw themselves as going to another system.
Ken, we've got about 7 or 8, but we do have 20 minutes, and that's good. Ken's next.
I ran a little rough figure under an MMP system to see what the seat allocation would be with like a 1% threshold for getting a seat. It worked out to 52 top-up seats altogether, and I'm wondering what kind of public reaction there generally is when you go from just a single-member system where it's a defined amount of seats, and all of a sudden you have the extra incurred cost, bureaucracy potential restructuring that goes along with top-up seats.
Top-up seats in what sense? That you actually increase the size of the legislature? Well, you could increase the size of the legislature under any system. MMP systems work so that basically you don't change the total system. You just simply shrink the number of local districts to provide for the proportional list systems, seats, and they all get that much bigger. Now, there is a problem that a party could actually win more seats than they're entitled to under proportional representation. And this happens not infrequently in Germany, because their seats are allocated on a regional basis in the German Länder. And what they do then is, if a party is entitled to 50% of the seats and they've already won more than that because they've won all the constituency seats, they just let them keep the extra ones, and the Bundestag gets bigger for the life of that parliament. These are the so-called Überhang or Mandate seats. People in Quebec who are trying to wrestle with ideas about whether they should go to some kind of system are all hung up on these. And they arguing to themselves, what are they going to do about this, and whether they're going to have Uber. They hate the idea. But there's a real possibility that you actually have to. It means the size of the legislature might vary a little bit if you're going to provide for that. Unless you're just going to take seats away from people they've already won at the constituency level, and that seems to be an arrangement that has no popularity.
So is it not an option to leave the amount of seats at 79 and then add, or like leave the districts the way they are and then add top-up seats?
Well, you could certainly do that. I think the logic of the mandate suggests we're there to, vote into the seats, and the logic is the kind of current number of seats. I mean, I guess if the Assembly decided to recommend that we double the size of the legislature, add 30% or something, you can. I guess my own gut instinct would be, you can imagine what the public response might be. I don't think there's a huge appetite for changing the size of the legislature in any significant way. And I think the mandate kind of implies that we're operating at about 79. I mean, if we recommended 80 or 78, that would be trivial.
I just, if I might, can just add on that. My interaction with the Attorney General in this is that I think they expect us to stay roughly where we are. My hunch is several seats is not going to make or break it, but not doubling the legislature. Rob is next, by the way, Ken.
Rob. Mike.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I was just wondering, with regards to the New Zealand legislature, when you were talking about members leaving or switching a party, and it's declared vacant, I wasn't quite clear on what you meant by that. Do you mean that they're now out of a job? Or is
yes, they've lost their seat. It's now declared vacant. They're no longer a member of the legislature. They decide they want to switch parties.
They're gone. Okay, thank you.
That's because the logic is that they say, well, look, we calculated the extra seats on the basis of proportionality, and by subtracting the number of seats you've already had, and since now you've changed that, you're threatening to change the proportionality, so we're going to declare the seat vacant. Of course, if you have a vacant list seat, you just go on the list, but if you have a vacant constituency seat in New Zealand, then you have a by-election. So there's a kind of funny potential contradiction there. But that's what they do. The Germans just have, we replace the constituency member with someone from the list. But you have to make that decision. You have to decide whether you're going to treat them both the same. And there are different consequences depending on what you decide there. There's just an endless series of decisions to make and choices when you, in all electoral systems.
Gladys.
Yes, Ken. I'm just wondering, in the MISC system, like Austria has, would there be any legal problems later on at the counting stage if they've got a different formula at the different stages?
No, the law just basically provides that's the way the system works. That, you know, that if the law is clear about how the system works, then you follow those practices. I mean, that's to call that a mixed system may be to slightly extend the notion of mixed a little bit, but what it does suggest is you can kind of mix different formulas and different levels, you know, as far as your imagination can take you. And it is generally mixed in some sense that there's a fundamentally different kind of emphasis in these two dimensions of the seat allocation. One is deliberately trying to help smaller parties within a PR framework. Another one is deliberately trying to help the larger parties. And they're doing that for different reasons with different numbers of seats and so on.
Derek.
Thanks. You've spoken to tensions within the Scottish Parliament between list members and constituency members. But I was curious if there's any distinction drawn by the public, by the media, in terms of legitimacy, respect accorded between the two members.
It's hard to know about the Scottish Assembly because it's so new. I mean, they just had the election for the second one. And, of course, when you get this kind of tension within parties and people complaining about it in public quite a lot, it gets into the media, and then it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And maybe it'll settle down. I mean, one thing you know is if you change the electoral system, it's not going to work perfectly the first time, or probably the second time or third time. Certainly, we can see in New Zealand there's kind of a learning process going on. They've gone through three elections now under this new system. After the first election, everybody was surprised at how it came out, and the coalition that everybody expected to form didn't get formed. Something quite different happened, and everybody was shocked, and, oh, this is outrageous. It's not what we expected. It's not what we promised. But then the kind of politicians began to figure it out, and the parties began to figure it out, and the voters began to figure it out. And by the third iteration, they'd begun to adopt new kind of habits and expectations. And so some of it may be a kind of settling in process. There still is, I think, a certain debate in New Zealand. Certainly if you talk to members of the legislature, some say, well, they're all the same, it's all fine. Others will be very vocal about, often it's the constituency members, about the wickedness of the system, right? I'm doing all the work, and, you know, she's got an easy ride, or vice versa. But, of course, you know, it kind of depends who you talk to. But the point is you have two very different kind of members with different obligations, different responsibilities, different connections to their parties, different connections to their voters. Now, for some, that's a real strength. That provides diversity and variety. For others, that provides kind of an unsettled balance. You know, one person's virtue is another person's vice.
Edith.
Okay, for the systems where they get two votes,
yes.
Where does the percentage of the top-up seats come from? The one where they voted for the party and it's the list one, or do they take the percentage of the popular vote on the constituency level?
It comes from the party vote, and that's why you have that party vote. Otherwise, you wouldn't need one. And I think there is in the packet somewhere an envelope with an example of a New Zealand ballot that says, there's two arrows. You vote for your candidate here and your party here, and you put a tick beside each one. They're basically ordinal ballots. You just put a tick in each of the two columns, one for a party, one for a candidate. And it's the party vote. And that means that small parties can get votes because if they were just counting up the list seats, small parties wouldn't be getting as many because people are saying, well, I'm not going to vote for a small party. It can't win. But on the list, I know that they'll get whatever they get, so I can vote for a small party here. And in Germany, the Free Democrats, and more recently the Germans, have been elected almost rarely winning any seats, but regularly part of the legislature and part of the coalitions because they're winning their share. Germany, they said, well, if we're going to do that, then we're going to have a threshold. They have a 5% threshold or three seats. In New Zealand, they have a, Hillary will contradict me if I'm wrong, but I think it's a 5% threshold or one seat. So parties that can win 5% and can get some share of the seats, or parties that can win only one local seat and maybe only 2% can get part of the share out. And those produce rather different kinds of parties, different kinds of campaigns.
Amanda.
Hi. You said candidates could run on both sides. I'm right here.
Oh, okay. Sorry, Amanda.
Yes. Candidates can run on both sides.
Or you could...
Can you make it so that they can't?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The parties wouldn't like that because they want to run their... They want to run their top candidates, their leader and their deputy leaders on a list, but they also want to run them in a constituency party to show they're not afraid to fight the battles, but they want them out there in the public. And you can require them. As I say, we know that there's a big debate going on in Quebec in the minister's office now because they have a minister for electoral reform. They're going to do it by government fiat. And I've talked to some of their advisors. One of the big debates is should they actually require people to run on both? On the principle that if they're going to run on the list, you've got to make them get out there in the constituency trenches and do the hard slogging, door knocking as well. But, of course, the more of that you do, the more of the so-called zombies you get. Now, never occurred to anyone in Germany that that's a bad thing or that there's anything unacceptable about it. The Japanese have got it in their head that it's appalling. So, I mean, that's the kind of cultural difference in terms of how you think about what's going on at the local level.
Darren, right in front of you, Ken.
Okay. Thanks, Darren.
Yes, Ken, I think you indicated, and it would be my thought, that most people are going to be interested in the mixed system because it seems to apply to so many of our opportunities. You also said that it will depend on the different needs of the voters. And my question is it the intention for us to receive presentations about population distribution, like where the densities are, what the lifestyle differences might be, what the regional issues might be, and how that might even relate to what local representation there is, both at the federal and the municipal levels. And the question is, I think we need that information in order to look at the mixed system intelligently.
Well, I think you will hear in submissions a certain amount of that kind of stuff. And a good deal of it lies behind arguments about local representation. I mean, it's kind of the essence of that. But people look at maps and see different things. People look at different population densities and see different things. I can tell you that if you talk to local members who come from rural agricultural areas, they say, oh, we have the hardest job of all. You know, we've got hundreds of square miles to drive around and it's snowing and blustery and we get to these little communities once a year and it's so hard. And you can talk to members who are in densely populated areas like Surrey. They'll say, those guys in the rural areas have it easy. You know, all their constituents are all the same. They're only worried about, you know, three areas. They've got farming and they've got this and they've got that. And it's kind of simple. I've got constituents who speak 28 different languages. And people who don't know where the border is and they don't care, they come into my office. And you know, I've got a whole, they have a different range of kind of issues. And so the kind of challenges that come to members, you're quite right, reflect the very different kind of constituencies they have. So the question is, are there systems that suit those kind of challenges better or worse? These are judgment calls. The kind of information one might want to answer that is almost infinite, depending on how you understood that.
I think there is a lot of information about population characteristics. And I mean, we can either go look for it ourselves. I'm just wondering if there's a way of having it presented to us.
Well, we could certainly find a way to provide a kind of socio-demographic kind of profile of the province and the variations of it in terms of densities and communities and so on. Kind of list of variables and what we might do that might be semi-infinite, but if it would be helpful, we could probably try and think of a way to do that.
Just one last point. I think it might be helpful. I know when you talk and I get the map out, I begin to learn a lot about British Columbia that I don't understand now. And one of the objectives here, I think, is to get a better understanding of what districts might mean. And that would mean how many people there are, what sort of people, the issues that they're dealing with. Otherwise, we'll be uninformed if we begin to look at mixed systems. So that would be a suggestion I would make.
And I think that's quite a good one, and we can try and think of ways we can do that. It's one of the reasons that lies behind the idea that we're hoping to have members go to public hearings in other parts of the province so they can kind of hear other British Columbians say some of these kinds of things. But that's a rather imperfect version of what you're suggesting.
Okay, we've got about six more and one for a second time in about 5 minutes. David's next.
Ken, in the MMP systems, it seems to me that they are systems where the party has control about who gets the seats, unlike the STV or open list systems. You didn't do your normal evaluations, and I understand that you're talking about different types of systems in your presentation, but would you care to comment on the how you would evaluate the MMP systems in terms of the parliamentary check on government and party democracy?
MMP systems really essentially work as proportional systems at the level of the whole parliament. So there are going to be more fragmented parliaments. With the exception of Scotland, most MMP parliaments are coalition parliaments. So clearly, the governments are more responsive or can be held to account more readily by the parliament as a whole, or some subset of it, its potential coalition partners, than single majority governments. So certainly MMP systems in Parliament work as PR systems. That's the point of them. In terms of political parties, what they do is they create a kind of bifurcated, fragmented organization. Because on the one hand, there's the party that's concerned with a kind of decentralized, constituency-focused kind of organization preoccupation, having to have organizations in local constituencies to fight local battles. But then there's the party that's trying to fight a list system and trying to be centralized and disciplined and do that. And kind of marrying those two can present very different kind of challenges. Certainly my sense of the New Zealand parties is the two big parties, the National Party and the Labour Party, are really struggling with that. I actually did some interesting interviewing with them last year, and they haven't worked out how to organize and how to operate. And there's clearly the party leadership has quite a good control over who's on the list, but they don't have much control over the constituency members. But mostly the constituency members get elected. Most of the small parties are list parties, and so therefore the possibility of a more centralized and disciplined organization is there. How they choose to organize internally varies quite a lot. Some of them are relatively open and democratic in their candidate selection. Others are extraordinarily autocratic, and you know, someone at the top just decides who's going to be the candidates and makes the list, and they go out and campaign. So in some sense, these systems are probably going to have more variety of different organizational styles. And I think that it will take some time to settle down. The only system which we have experience that goes back more than about 10 years or about three electoral cycles is the German one. All the others are so new that we're still kind of learning how they work and how they're going to finally settle out. Maybe not a very
good answer. We now have more questions. We have time. I'm going to give you a couple more, Ken, and then those who didn't get their questions asked, when we come back for the kind of wrap-up, if there's a question in period, we'll get you let you have first crack at
the
it,
facilitators
okay?
Facilitators all are smart.
They're smart, too. Julie.
My question is more of a question for general consideration. We are quite interested in the mixed system, and I agree with Ray that we've been leaning towards that. But given that the Attorney General expects us to leave the size of the legislature as it is, and given that the Supreme Court has sort of mandated the voter size or comparative voter size between the electoral districts that would preclude that we would have to recommend a potentially major increase to the physical size of already very large constituencies, in particular in the rural area of BC. And I think that would be a really hard sell. I almost feel like we're damned if we do and damned if we don't. While we see the advantages of the mixed system, and there are a lot, I think that given the physical size of our province, in particular in comparison to the physical size of a country like Germany, we're not comparing apples to apples. And I think that people would be, it would be very difficult to sell an increase in the constituency size to people.
I think you've identified the dilemma very well. And but it's the fact that I'm not a member, I don't have to make that decision. Is that it, Jack?
Yeah, I think we'll keep the other questions over. Ask your discussion leaders, or I'll give you priority when you come back. Thank you very much. Do get to your discussion groups at 11, by the way. 5-2 if you can. Thanks. Thank you very much, Ken.